Well, hi, everybody. Welcome, and thanks very much for the responses and feedback that you've given. I want to begin with asking if there is any takeaway from last seminar that has been helpful to you, or a remaining question or clarification from our last seminar, either or, from anyone. I'm hearing what you're each saying in the emails about wanting to look at applications, and I'm going to work in some case illustrations about application to be sure that you have not just the principles and tools and methods, but real takeaways about how to put this into practice, how to listen and respond from a broader base of information to really integrate the mind and brain and performance sciences. So any responses, questions, anything, what you got? Anything that would be helpful to discuss just briefly before we move into our topic? If not, I'll put us on lecture mode and come back, and we'll have just a bit of time at the end. So jot down any questions or clarifications you have, and we'll come back to them. Okay, we're on lecture mode now, so you don't have to worry about background noise. So we're going to talk in this seminar about peak performance under pressure, and that covers the waterfront from anyone from parenting to executive to coaching to sports, anything where there might be a shift of a state of mind to really look at how we can regulate that and create a peak performance in practice and in performance. So first, to look at an optimum performance mindset. And again, the essence of this is in your outline. And I'll stick mostly to the outline. The physiological response in your body and the activation in your brain to excitement and to fear are exactly the same. Your body and your brain can't tell the difference between the two. The only difference between excitement and fear is how you frame it. With a response of fear or anxiety, your mind and brain search for what's wrong and lights on something that consciously makes sense and connects cause and effect. And this association creates closure and seems to be the cause and effect that you're looking for. Linking this physiological response and this brain response with a negative meaning reads as fear. It boots up the mindset that you use then to frame the rest of the conversation or the engagement. So the framing here is crucial in the very beginning. So this is why when we talk about working with someone in coaching, we want to be able to understand this to help them create a framework, first of collaboration with us, and then a framework that they can optimize how they engage and how they respond. So with a response, for example, of fear or anxiety, your mind and brain then search for what's wrong, and the association creates closure. Linking this physiological response with a negative meaning reads as fear. So just before you begin a task in which you've increased activation of alertness, heart racing, sweaty palms, instead of automatically linking anxiety or fear, then looking for what caused it or what can go wrong, look at the framing instead of, I'm excited, I'm ready. Reframe to ask, I'm ready to do this. What's next? This provides a positive framework of anticipatory readiness. As you're working with a client and they launch into the beginning of, well, this is the problem that I face, this may be a time you want to frame the possibility or the opportunity to look at creating a new and different response. Because once someone goes into that problem. They are etching further already existing networks and neural connections in their brain. So that's why and how people get stuck in therapy. They know all there is to know about something, but yet they're still recreating the same story. So what this means then, in one sense, performance anxiety is an indication of how much you care both about performance and outcome. It's normal. It's even necessary to feel anticipatory or just anxious in preparation for optimal performance, as long as you frame the anxiety as the excitement so that you channel it into performing well. Consider the anxiety as your mind and body preparing itself to perform and then execute in the successful way you practice. I'll give you an illustration of this from a mentor coaching client in just a moment. A key to consistent performance is to electively enter and then sustain an optimum state of mind for a specific performance task. Preparation includes self-reflection to identify and monitor the specific state of mind for optimum performance. Consistency then requires having a systematic strategy to stay grounded and centered so that no subsequent experience or event disrupts that state of flow, and to have a way to reboot if you're derailed. That's part of the anticipation and plan. When a performer in any endeavor has practiced essentially the same tens of thousands of hours as the next person, whether that's an executive, a sports performer, a surgeon, outcome is determined more by optimum mental state and effective sustained focus for peak performance. Same when you work with a client. A significant number of studies find the most common psychological characteristics of an optimum performance to be these five: confidence from positive expectations about performance. That doesn't just happen. You frame it that way. And we'll talk about a way to do that in a moment. Full concentration with focus on the present task. Strong determination and commitment, sustaining the focus, in other words. Feeling energized but relaxed. And again, back to focus, the mental toughness of determined focus under pressure. And this is where if you notice even in an instant that you have lost that focus or have a thought, reboot, reframe, look at what the next step is. Have a way to immediately get centered and grounded. We talked a bit about that the last time. Now, a routine is effective because when it's repeated enough, the brain creates a neuronal pathway and network to make this a default mode, to become automatic, so it doesn't require much energy. Studies have shown that athletes who use a pre-performance routine do optimum performance state of mind to ensure access to the software specific to that deliberate practice and the execution of the skills in that mindset. A routine can guide focus and enhance effectiveness and mastery to execute a best plan of action throughout a performance. And it may be that a brief mantra before a keynote is another example. I can return to that if you'd like. Whenever you do something that's really important, have a way of instantly getting grounded and centered. For me, it's simply, before a keynote, for example, touching my index finger and thumb on one hand while I'm taking one deep breath of relaxation and saying a mantra, relaxed and powerful. And within 4 to 5 seconds, I'm ready to go. Now, here's a concept from sports science that can be a strategy of controlling attention. The quiet eye is a selective focus on the most significant target immediately prior to executing a practice skill. So the quiet eye is the final step of any important performance sequence. and it's been shown to be especially important when performing under pressure. So here's what we know about it, just in a brief overview. Eye tracking research on the quiet eye shows that for a precise motor task, for example, like free throw shooting or putting or tying a surgical knot, experts maintain quiet eye 62% longer than non-experts. Quiet eye focus specifically increases precision. Academic and business performers can learn a lot from research in athletic settings to apply the quiet eye concept. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain and has the functional role of readying the entire system for the next step. So basically, quiet eye training enhances the default motor system execution of skills for a specific task. Sports science shows the benefits of choosing the best visual target, for example, for purposeful and goal-directed eye movement. Here's an example. When basketball players miss free shots, they often instantaneously move focus from the rim where the ball is going to the ball itself. When soccer players miss a penalty shot, it's been found that they may instantly compromise their focus from the destination at a specific point just inside the goalpost to the goalkeeper, only a foot or two away maybe, but it has the result of diverting that ultimate target and the specificity of the action. Or an executive sidetracked by an emotional reaction to a colleague. Or, as a coach, you're instantly distracted because you want to give your client a recommendation or offer a solution instead of staying with the story that they're developing. Now, here's an example of this that I hope will be helpful. It's about self-talk, basically, and peak performance. A CEO, I'll call Dan, had a tragedy at his company, a serious accident, and on-the-job injuries and the death at one of the operating sites. In the 3 months since the accident, he had stress-related symptoms, losing sleep, depleted energy, preoccupation with safety. He recognized that his responses hampered his effectiveness as an executive and his ability to provide the leadership that his company needed. He was noticing it trickle down to have an impact on the whole mood and state of mind of the executives and those below him. I asked Dan what went through his mind the instant that he woke up. His answer is, well, what could go wrong today? And this is 3 months after the horrible accident. He described questions about what he could do for his company, how he could not feel helpless, how he could assure the group about there being no more accidents, how he could mitigate any potential future danger. So basically, he was playing not to lose. He was focusing on the negative. He recognized that the mindset he began each day for the 3 months since that event had been essentially the same, and he had set the tone both for himself and his corporation. His concern had permeated not only his executive team, but to each employee. He knew he had to do something different, but he wasn't quite sure what different was, because nothing had seemed to work for very long. We began with a very simple approach. I suggested he try something different. I explained that we're always asking ourselves questions, whether or not we're conscious of them, from the moment we wake up. And he had already said, from the instant he woke up, he was asking questions about what could go wrong and how to prevent that. This inner dialogue is almost unconscious, but at stressful times, which it was for him, it includes question of what's going to happen today? Will I be able to handle it? What am I most afraid of? Or, well, today's April the 15th. What's going to happen with my taxes? I suggest that's not an evergreen comment. I suggested that sometime during the day or the evening before he went to bed, that he write down three questions that would put him in an empowered, positive state of mind to answer them. Questions that would focus on his effectiveness of what he could do rather than what he could not do. That would instantly boot up a state of mind of confidence and mastery. Questions that might include empowering positive mindset prompts like powerful, accomplished, unstoppable, and then to answer each of those three questions as soon as you woke up. The next week at our session, he immediately reported the difference those questions had made. He recognized that he had previously begun every day with negative self-talk and had created a mindset of a lack of confidence and the stress that came with that. And with that mindset, he processed essentially the remainder of the day and noticed how contagious it was in his organization. He knew that's not what had created his successes or his corporation's successes. By shifting consciously to positive self-talk, framing it in a positive way to engage the day, it built throughout the day. This initial reframing of his self-narrative to direct power focus to launch a positive state of mind to engage the day became a model that he passed on directly and indirectly to his organization. He noticed within days the impact it had on his executive team and how this change trickled down through the organization. So this seems so simple, but yet from a mind and brain perspective, it's an entirely different framework and way of proceeding. Self-talk becomes an internal dialogue that can build confidence and create affirmations to enhance performance, or it can do the reverse. And keep in mind this, self-talk should not counter the negative, because remember, we get what we focus on, not what we want. Focusing on the negative, even to avoid it, engages the negative. So focus on the positive and the empowering. We always get what we focus on. The unconscious does not know the difference between positive or negative, just the focus. So a positive self-talk in the present moment can immediately replace the negative focus. And it's important to recognize that a different set of strategies, including self-talk and affirmations, may be needed in different performance arenas. So think about the different contexts. In athletics, a runner may need a focus phrase of powerful and steady, or keep your pace during races, especially today during the Boston Marathon, during the longer runs. This is useful. Or an I am the storm to keep from knocking off early for a single malt and a cigar. The focus phrase needs to fit the endeavor. Now, here's an example I hadn't thought about using, but I want to do it very quickly. I've worked with pro golfers, and the focus phrase for someone really getting into an instant state of mind for performance when they're driving, when they're going off the tee, maybe a phrase like relaxed and powerful because they want a big booming drive. Their middle game with the irons may need to be relaxed and precise. When they get on the green, it may be relaxed and smooth. And think about how you might have a different, in a very simple way, a different focus phrase when you get up to do a keynote. You know, you don't want to be relaxed and powerful when you're going to sleep at night. So if you want to go to sleep more effectively, the relaxation and a focus phrase may be something like relaxed to sleep. And the focus of the breath and anything that deviates from that will simply activate your brain rather than continue. So that's why a model of mindfulness meditation is a great model for relaxation, for effectively going to sleep, and it's a model that can be applied to coaching because your focus on your client can remain in a sustained way throughout the entire, and you have a different thought, you want to run in a play, you think about something that you're identifying with in the client, you move back to the focus just on your client. So the stories we tell ourselves, our self-talk of internal conversation, frames our experience that can either sustain it or short-circuit it. Self-awareness becomes the crucial component to both modify and monitor and understand this process. And here's a simpler way to say it. The most common reason you don't get what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. So let's expand just a little bit about self-talk. This can enhance resilience and facilitate rebound from failure. Engineering professors David Franklin and Daniel Wolpert have identified 5 mechanisms of brain operation, related but distinct, when someone successfully bounces back from failure. These are some of the studies that I love, of looking at successes and asking why and approaching that in a scientific way. Each of these 5 brain mechanisms has a specific corresponding brain function that can help us directly access and create an inner dialogue for self-talk to rebound from failure with resilience to transform that to success. One is redirect negative feedback. Whether internal or external, this focuses energy in a negative way. So a question for reflection, what can I learn from this? What are the possibilities here rather than the problem? And remember, the questions for self-reflection can also be the questions from you as a coach for your client. Second, recognize that obstacles are created. They're not nouns, they're verbs. Consider that the obstacle you're experiencing is not something external that you may need to strategize in a way to overcome or get around, but it's not there until you create it. To say this in a different way, an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. When you're ready to consider that you're creating the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So here's the self-reflection question for this. What would it be like to not create the obstacle and instead to put energy to what you want? The third, use systematic forecasting. We already use invisible brain algorithms to predict the future. Our brain creates new pathways and networks for anything that we repeat, so it develops a default mode to save energy. These hardwired patterns become predictive because they create the story that we anticipate even unconsciously. So to preempt this automatic system, we have to consciously self-reflect to see if the software developed at an earlier time and place is still applicable for the current situation, or if it's outdated and we need to predict and respond differently. This, in coaching, we refer to as story busting, to break the script and ask about a different way of thinking about it. So here's the self-reflection question. Is my usual pattern optimum for this current situation? Or assess the current model. Self-reflect to assess the effectiveness of what you're doing, not what you want to happen and continue to inhabit the story of what you want to happen, but is it working right now? This requires at times disruption of automatic expectations and not continuing to inhabit the story you want to believe. So the self-reflection question here is very short and sweet. Is my plan really working or not? 5, the output channel is essential. No matter how much we acquire information and study and learn, it's by putting it into action, the output channel, that we not only enhance effectiveness, but actually create a performance memory. So, and that's why I suggest writing down the primary thing you're taking away from each seminar that you think will be helpful to you. You're putting it in an output channel. The self-reflection question here, what do I next need to put into action? Now, let's look at some aspects of actually performing under pressure. All teams, ranging from business organizations to sports, like to think they do their best when the stakes are highest, when the future rests on the immediate outcome. But that's not how it happens. How you handle yourself in difficult and challenging moments determines success more than how you handle yourself in normal times. In extensive studies of teams, Professor Heidi Gardner at Harvard saw three performance pressure patterns that compromise results. So this study is about teams, but also think of it in terms of your individual clients. One, when teams, sports to executive teams, become caught up in the risk of failure rather than the pursuit of excellence, they revert to standard and safe practices instead of looking for original solutions, or to the default mode rather than to stick with the game plan. Secondly, when teams face significant performance pressure, they tend to defer to high-status members rather than using expert members and information. And thirdly, when an individual or team either fails to perform well when strongly favored or else squanders a big lead in an important event due to excessive pressure. So, research on performing under pressure consistently shows that most people perform below their capacity when under pressure. This occurs in instances ranging from parallel parking and a driving test to a big job interview or to a major business deal. Pressure erodes behavioral skills and our ability to perform. And here's the key for us as coaches, unless it's managed in an informed, systematic manner. That's what you offer your clients. That's what you offer yourself first. So our attention, judgment, and decision-making are adversely affected unless pressure is strategically planned and regulated. And that includes not getting caught up in a fear of failure or simply playing not to lose. So here are three simple definitions that we're really talking about. And it's important, I think, to distinguish among these three. Stress is generated in any situation when there are too many demands and too few resources to meet those demands, like energy, time, or money. Pressure results from the significance we give a situation, the expectations we place on our performance, and our stake in the outcome. And state of mind is a mind-body state, as we've discussed, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So state of mind is a particular set of emotions, memories, mental models, and behavioral patterns informed by deliberate practice. So this is the first step to get in the state of mind for practice, to develop this software, these responses to become automatic, and then to sustain that state through practice and through performance so that there's full access to it. So let's talk just a little bit about resilience in performance. I think I included the quote in your outline from Dean Becker. More than education, more than experience, more than training, a person's level of resilience will determine who succeeds and who fails. That's as true in the cancer ward, as is true in the Olympics, as it's true in the boardroom. Here's an example. Theo Epstein guided the Boston Red Sox to their first World Series victory in 86 years. Then he agreed in 2011 to lead the Chicago Cubs, whose last World Series championship was in 1908. The Cubs then won in 2016 108 years later. So, Epstein was widely touted as having an innate and rare intelligence to deconstruct a situation to its simplest form and generate strategic possibilities. He was then asked how he decides what he looks for in putting together a team. He indicated that he scouts the person more than the player. Epstein said the first thing he wants to know about any potential player is how he's handled adversity. Resilience grows by converting mistakes into lessons. This is what we help our clients do. By reflecting on and learning from mistakes, we convert a regrettable experience into a learning experience. The framing, what can we learn from this? What are the possibilities here? Instead of plunging back into the problem and the mistakes and trying to analyze or deconstruct that. Resilience is the ability to modulate and constructively harness the stress response. This is essential to physical and mental health as well as every kind of performance. Success in any arena hinges on resilience. Management of setbacks to productively progress becomes an essential process of optimum performance. Persistence toward a goal in the face of challenges characterizes success from athletes to executives to practicing and performing professionals. A resilient individual is not somebody who avoids stress, but someone who learns how to effectively master it and optimize performance while doing so. So here are four simple steps that can boost resilience to reframe or reinterpret negative events. What's the possibility here? To enhance positive emotion, to engage enthusiastically in possibility. Remember, the brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. How you frame it determines how you perceive. If you frame it as excitement and engage it, it's a different mindset and a different process. You're using different software, so you're going to experience and create in a different way. A third and fourth component, becoming physically fit and having a supportive network to sustain resilient role models, to have people you can rely on, from friends, colleagues, mentor, coaches. The ability to regulate states of mind and manage emotions is central to establishing resilience. Two approaches demonstrated in recent research to regulate states of mind and enhance resilience are these two: cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation. Cognitive reappraisal is simply just a fancy term to reframe from a negative to a positive, from problem to possibility, in order to reinterpret the meaning, let's say, of an adverse event, to see it as challenge and opportunity. Think about how you do that regularly with your clients. A Mount Sinai School of Medicine study of Vietnam prisoners of war found that those who had actively reappraised their imprisonment to find meaningful ways in which to grow stronger and more resilient showed far and away the most adaptive responses and resultant health, mentally and physically. Mindfulness meditation, we've talked about that already as a model to focus on how to get grounded and centered in the present moment. And this does not include following or tracking any thought, dwelling in the past, fretting about the future, negative rumination or self-talk. It's simply a way of staying very present and very focused on very fundamental things like your breath. It's been associated with improved ability to focus, increased flexibility of thinking, and greater psychological well-being. Both cognitive reappraisal and mindfulness meditation have been shown to activate the left prefrontal cortex, a brain pattern that's associated with greater emotional control, boost of positive emotions, and faster recovery from uncomfortable feelings. It's also been shown in very recent research how mindfulness meditation actually enhances our immune response and immunoglobulins associated with immune responses are increased, measured to be increased by regular mindfulness meditation. Now, I want to go back with you to what we talked about before, the neural conditioning chart. Remember the one page and the four columns. That can be applied here. And remember I gave you the case study. In the first column, the emotional triggers, I'd suggest doing this exercise yourself. List the situations that can instantly induce an emotional reaction that may be negative or distracting. In the second column, usual response, write your usual reactive response for each situation. And I'd suggest when you do this to schedule a time for yourself, a time that's uninterrupted where you can really focus on this for at least maybe 30 or 40 minutes. So look at any emotional triggers that are distracting. And for each trigger, the resultant behavior or reactive emotion that you have. This is not to focus on the negative, but just to cue your radar to more quickly recognize it, to then be able to move to the third column to do a mantra, to get grounded and centered, and then have a pre-planned optimum response in the fourth column. So this systematic strategy of early recognition, grounding, and an ideal response can restore balance and regulate state of mind and create a more optimum response in various situations. Now, here's something to consider about mental energy restoration for optimum performance. At times, we may view rest as passive, such as an athlete seeing it as not training. That, though, is a part of both practice and performance. A buddy of mine, who's a neuropsychiatrist at Harvard, Dr. Sereny Pillay, he's done a book that I would highly recommend, Tinker, Dabble, Doodle, Try. He looks at this as a period of unfocus. In other words, to frame rest and unfocused time to support achievement and to create a framework that's effective and proactive. So in this reframe, rest becomes a crucial component of work performance. It's an active process psychologically and physically. So here are some examples of studies that have measured specific tasks and optimizing results. What he found is that for every hour of work, if you work for 54 minutes and then take a walk in nature for 6 minutes, when you get back to the cognitive task, you have 40% improvement in the cognitive task. If you can only do this, as he does at Harvard, at times of bad weather, only by looking out into nature, it's still 75% as effective as doing. So this is a time to kind of reboot. There have been a number of studies, and I'm just going to summarize it instead of going into them, but for every kind of work, from cognitive to physical, there's an optimum amount of time for immersion in work and for a restorative function. For example, for farm workers, it's 75 minutes of work and a 15-minute break. And this has been done for everything, including up to, you know, meat packers. I promise not to bore you with all that, but there is some significant research on how to take a break for cognitive restoration. So here's an example that I want to just present you with, and this is a kind of reiteration about the positive versus the negative framework. And it can be subtle. When a soccer penalty kick is done, every kicker is the same 12 yards away, 72 square foot target, one goalie guarding. Now, when the framework is playing to win, in other words, when making the goal will result in a win, kickers are successful 92% of the time. When the player, the kicker, is playing not to lose, in other words, the team is down by one, you have to make it to tie. And if you miss, your team will lose. Success rate is 62%. Same distance, same target, two different mindsets. 30% difference in success rate. So in the threat mindset, expectations are high. There's a feeling of judgment. You can't make a single mistake. You play not to lose. So the result has more anxiety, booting up an entirely different mindset from the playing to win mindset. So playing to win is based in confidence, not based in fear. It optimizes performance. Not to lose is defensive. Playing to win is thriving and superiority. Playing not to lose is surviving and mediocre. Playing to win creates optimal experience. Playing not to lose creates a potential success, a stressful experience. And playing to win enhances abilities. Playing not to lose compromises the expression of abilities, whether cognitive or physical. So this is important, I think, in anything you do, from coaching to any other kind of engagement that you have. So I want to talk just as a brief overview about how to manage performance anxiety. And remember, performance can depend on how you frame either anxiety or excitement. If you view it as a necessary component to boost performance, it can fuel optimum performance. Focus remains on the state of flow of the successful execution of the skill, whatever its nature, cognitive, physical, or a combination. So let's consider four most common success completion issues, things that can interfere with this process. One is choking. Now, think about when you're working with a client and the client mentions something that causes you to think about something personally, so for an instant you're distracted. That's a choke. If you're playing at an elite level of performance and you're in the flow of the game, you stop for an instant to think about what you should do. Or somebody in the crowd is distracting you. That's a choke. So a choke is botching any routine behavior. It can be forgetting lines that an actor has had and said numbers of times, hundreds of times. Blanking on the name of somebody the person knows quite well. Flubbing a well-practiced presentation. Or just simply botching a routine behavior like catching a pass in a big game. Here's where it comes from. You may know this. When Jackie Robinson grabbed his throat in a game between St. Louis and the Dodgers, when umpire Bill Stewart badly missed a call, Stewart threw him out of the game. So choking became a common term for blowing it. Now, choking usually refers to not executing a specific skill under pressure that you would more likely execute well under normal situation. So the challenge here, the prevention, is to stay in state and to get in state of performance, whatever that is, whether you're a coach, a surgeon, an athlete, an executive. Framing a situation can be important. So here are a couple of things that can distract. If you frame a situation as a unique experience, like, this is my biggest game, there'll never be an opportunity like it. Today I make history. Thinking of a pressure moment as a single shot can heighten the sense of risk and loss. With athletes, for example, loss aversion creates a behavior of playing not to lose instead of playing to win. Here's an example. And this was back when I was a Houston Astros fan, before they cheated. In the 2017 American League Baseball Championship, the starting Astros pitcher in Game 3 against the Yankees was Charlie Martin. When he was interviewed just before the game, he said, "This is the biggest game of my life." And my response as an Astros fan at that time was, "Oh, no." The Yankees got 6 runs in the first 2 innings. You know, so see how my grandmother was right? If you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. The other is exaggerating the situation, becoming too attached to the outcome, intensifying any kind of fear or anxiety or focus on playing not to lose. Anxiety, any hint of that even, can shift a state. So there's a loss of focus and a move away from working memory, from the zone of practice and performance. So simply the meaning we ascribe to an event can dictate our response. And another example, I hope we have time and I'm not taking away from our discussion. The ability to remain focused and regulate a state of mind affects both mindset and behavior. An example is in research examining 185 venture capital pitches. The variables of calmness, passion, eye contact, and confidence were significantly greater predictors of outcome than content, experience, expertise, and spreadsheets. These behavioral responses to pressure of sustaining a balanced state of mind and a specific mindset of confidence ensured the most favorable outcomes. Another, and I'll just briefly overview these, self-handicaps. Dr. Eddie O'Connor reported the recognition of self-handicapping himself as a runner. He recognized in not reaching his goal for the half mile, his goal was 2:10, that he was holding back to have something left at the end of each race, coupled with the hope that he could get there the next time by trying harder. So he kept hope alive in two ways. He recognized that preserving the hope of doing better was actually interfering with doing better. So the remedy for self-handicaps, self-reflection, and awareness of this process. Third, sandbagging. Sandbagging attempts to demonstrate in some way a limitation or a negative aspect so that others have a lessened expectation of you. You hear this all the time with coaches, for example. Sandbagging is designed to diminish the pressure of performance anxiety, or so you think. In one study, sandbaggers who predicted lesser performance actually made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, I may have lost, but it doesn't really count because I didn't try. So, a specific remedy for sandbagging? Change self-talk. And four, burnout. This is a syndrome that's a collection of things, including a diminished emotional drive, concentration, motivation, enthusiasm for something. It's often a result of a chronic experience of stressful performance and maybe just tension, fatigue, lethargy, leading to lessened passion and consistency. The remedy for burnout is mindfulness with reappraisal and re-engagement. And this is, I think, especially important. Now, I have in the outline, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I've listed here with just a simple explanation for each, pressure management tools. Now, this is not something you're going to present or methodically go over with your client. This is all, as all of our seminars are, for your information to inform your approaches, not to be a play that you run in or an assessment that you do, but simply a way to think about things in a more systematic way to collaboratively get to a better place with your client. These pressure management tools simply may be a strategy or a method to regulate pressure moments to create an optimum performance. And again, regulating a state of mind maybe just by reframing the pressure of the moment, can focus and guide behavior. So I'll just go over some highlights here. The considerations to regulate and redirect focus and flow first, always, is getting grounded and centered so that you have access to all of the information and all of your states of mind, especially to access the state of mind that's optimum for the task for focus on this particular thing. It may be helpful to recall previous successes that can frame a positive engagement to then focus. Perhaps to reframe the pressure moment as a challenge or an opportunity. This may be something you may want to actively engage with the client when they're talking about a pressure moment. And remember, first, in my view, is usually an empathic resonance with the client so that they really know you're collaboratively engaged with them and you're understanding their experience. Or they'll keep trying to tell you so that they know that you get it. If they're in a pressure moment, you may simply resonate in a way that you may understand, you know, I hear the pressure that you feel under. Let's look at a way to frame that, to engage in a stepwise way to create a strategy in that situation. So when there are a whole bunch of things, you may ask the client to pick one instance to focus on together that can then be used as a model for how to proceed and a template for how they approach other things when you're not on the other end of the conversation. It may be helpful at times to keep the needs and ideals of the person in mind when they're creating a game plan, that whatever they do needs to be consistent with who they are. And if they consider each situation an opportunity to develop and improve, and part of back to the top here, part of the establishment of being grounded and centered is the state of mind that includes ideally confidence. Confidence is a state of mind. It can frame how you approach what you do. So this may be approached, for example, by a recalling of a previous success of something that is the most similar that the person has done before, and how they did it, so that that can inform not just a strategy or techniques, but an entire frame of mind. And confidence, again, is a state of mind. It keeps ideals and positive attributes in focus. And what you're listening for in your client through the session is how they can sustain focus on what they've determined, and that what they've determined is in their control, what they can do rather than what they hope somebody else would do or what they hope would happen, to sustain focus on what they can determine and whatever they need to do to stay grounded and centered. The more that you train or practice under pressure conditions, the better you'll develop the elite performance. Now, we talked about the roadmap system for performing under pressure, and I want to go back to our initial seminar to look at understanding the algorithms that you're seeing in terms of behavior responses. Somewhere inside of each of us are the algorithms, the self-contained sequence or patterns for behavior, attachment, emotions. You will hear every algorithm that your clients have. It's there in their brain. It's going to manifest in the process. It may not be conscious. And again, the operating system for each person is 90 to 95% unconscious. So you're going to see where you're going to earn your money is listening for the process of listening for things that facilitate and enhance what your client does to establish a framework for practicing and performance that we're talking about now and developing that in a systematic way so that your client not only has that model, but they also have a way of creating that model or new and different situations that they'll experience when you're nowhere on the horizon. So let's do a brief overview to give you an idea of one way to use this method for yourself. And remember, any emotional trigger can create an instantaneous state change. So awareness of the process can help you to recognize the need to regulate and get grounded and centered, to use your mantra. The awareness of the trigger and the instantaneous state change. In that column two, every emotional reaction, every reaction to an emotional trigger, that's not going to change. That's why therapy doesn't work for many people. That second column is a time capsule. The negative self-talk, all the things that are hardwired, that exist in those behavioral and emotional responses, the most effective way, and usually the impossible way to deal with that, is try to change that. Instead, to look at recognizing that as quickly as possible, the emotional trigger and the resultant response, to then get grounded and centered, to move to a pre-planned ideal response. So, work with the first emotional trigger you wrote, if you did, in that neural conditioning chart. Go through the seven steps that you can use the roadmap process as an illustration to address that in a better way. So here's the roadmap briefly and all too succinctly applied in the last couple of minutes. And the roadmap again is the acronym. Recognize the emotional trigger for your state of mind, column one. And again, our brain works like a Google map to boot up a specific mindset. Being aware is always the first step. And the emotional trigger may be the signal of anxiety right before you have a response that you think is the cause. The cause is the emotional trigger. That's what boots up all the changes and all the states of mind content in the second column. The second column is not the cause. It's the result. That's huge. Second step, observe the state change distortions that follow. The column two, the content. The beliefs, doubts, anxiety, negative self-talk, those are the result. Third step, assess for the ideal state of mind to access it. Column three, a mantra to get grounded and centered to then develop an optimum state. And I know I'm combining a microsystem here with a macrosystem. The microsystem is the neural conditioning chart, and the macrosystem is the roadmap. And then the D of the roadmap, decide on a predetermined strategy, the ideal response from your fourth column, or maybe a pressure management tool for an ideal response or behavior. Next step, map the next best action. A challenge can violate the default story expectation. Specifically, an ideal performance plan is developed with deliberate practice, and you can go to that with greater and greater ease. Author, next step, the ideal response. Execute the optimum performance. And then finally, and this is a concept, but it's an important bedrock, program your peak performance identity. This transforms how and who you see yourself, doing and being in the optimum performance zone. Confidence when you are grounded and centered to know that when you work with a client, that they're going to get better than they have ever been in their life before because of the work with them. That confidence will be contagious. One of the most powerful forces in the human psyche is we always return to our core identity. You know, it's kind of like when someone trips, you hear their native language. When new behaviors incorporated into core identity, it becomes permanent. That's what we do in coaching. Change that lasts then becomes the default mode. Your brain has rewired. And this is what makes change permanent. I just recognize that I have gone over, so I want to respect the time. I welcome any responses, questions that you have by email. I'll add some additional time, 10 or 15 minutes, at the end of our last seminar next week if you'd like to discuss anything that we haven't gone into in enough detail, or do a vignette or a challenge or anything you'd like to discuss more. Have that ready, or even send me a preface to it, and we can address that in our at the end of our next seminar, and have more of a kind of an open mic discussion in case that might be helpful to you. Thank you for all your responses, your kind words, and I welcome anything that you may want to send or add or ask, and I look forward to our final seminar next week and the discussion that follows. Thanks very, very much. See you guys.